So this is a session about rethinking how to communicate science. And I'll go ahead and start. My name is Laura Herman, and I am with the Chicago Justice Project. I also work for a consulting firm in Washington, D.C. called Potomac Communication. And what brings me here today is I've studied the science of communication. It's what I do professionally. And through both Potomac and the Chicago Justice Project, I have come into this era of big data and have some thoughts that I want to get everybody's opinions on here today. I'm really excited to be here. So the purpose of this session is to really think about how the way science is done is changing and how that's changing journalism. And as somebody who's really studied and built my workday around the science of communication, I implement that by helping clients really start to communicate science. So I'm going to share some examples with you today about how scientists are using information technology differently and how that gives us a different set of tools to use to communicate about science. So the big picture of what I want to talk about is that science communication is changing because science is changing. And there are a number of ways that that starts to take shape. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Also want to talk about how persuasion is affected. I have the advantage of working with a really diverse group of people, everything from rocket scientists to beat cops. And they're all using information in really interesting and creative ways. If you're familiar with the CompStat model in New York City, police departments are using computational statistics to figure out how to allocate resources. In the same way, if you look at rocket scientists are developing new computational models to understand the natural world around us. As a result of this, there's a whole new set of tools out there that help us to interpret and discover things and explore the world around us. And that changes the way communicators, whether we're science writers or programmers, coders, it changes the way that we have source material to work with to tell stories and to narrate what's going on and interpret the fundamentals of what's there. So a lot of this came into, I guess, a question for the audience here is, how many folks here are familiar with Edward Tufte and the visual display of quantitative information? Okay. You know, this is really a starting point for many of us when we look at how do we take science and the ability to quantify information, how do we take that and turn it into something that is relevant and compelling for diverse audiences. Now, the problem that I have with Tufte's book, it's great and I still subscribe to it, but I think in today's environment, the visual display of quantitative information is in some ways, it's necessary but insufficient because we have an interactive expectation among our audiences today. And that starts to change how, as science writers, we need to look at the science that's out there. It's also how scientists are changing the way they look at information. So I want to think about that because in this new evolution, you know, the visual of display of quantitative information, Tufte's book, it came out in 1983. It was 30 years ago. And a lot has changed since then. And so while what he portrays as content being king is still true, context becomes increasingly important. And what I want to walk through are some examples of how scientists are using the new technology available to them. I want to talk about how science writers and computer programmers, which I put into that category of science writers now, how they are interpreting that information. And finally, some lessons that we've learned in the Chicago Justice Project in taking large data sets and making sense out of them. So that's what I'm going to talk about over the next hour. I realize that there are people here who know a lot more about aspects of what I'm going to talk about, and so please bear with me as I skip over some pretty detailed stuff about data visualization and journalism and about quantitative displays and big data management. I really want to start to explore these ideas with you and give you this overview. So I'm not pretending to be an expert on all of these topics. I'm really more of a generalist who I see my role as being the one who helps to integrate what artists and scientists are doing together so that we have a meaningful way to look and understand the world around us. And I take on that role as an integrator really seriously because I spend so much time with brilliant people who say over and over again, well, the facts should just speak for themselves because I'm a scientist and the empirical method works and I've done this research and I know this information. And tell me, Laura, how can you help me express this to another audience? And so often, the facts are not persuasive in and of themselves. And there's a whole nother session or two about why facts and science are difficult for people to accept and embrace on the face value. But what's important is to recognize that the persuasive nature of facts becomes, we're entering a new era for that persuasive era. With big data and the power of analytics, we've got this opportunity to take numbers and things that are counted and create infographics, which may be more or less informative. And I think that's a really important thing to recognize now, is how can we be responsible with the information that we have access to and make it accessible to broader audiences in a way that maintains the integrity of that information. The nuclear scientists that I work with, I do a lot of work with the national laboratories, and they are researching fundamental science. And they always want to know how they can help people understand basic physics, like the solar flares that we read about earlier this week. How do we help people understand the impact of these scientific events without scaring them and without undermining the basic science behind these issues? It's challenging because the physicists I work with often want to reach the general public, and they don't really think about audiences and how they can start to connect with a single audience or narrow cast into audiences and really relate to what those audiences are specifically interested in. And I think that is challenging because it's a different way of thinking about scientific research to think about how it gets applied. And the distinction between how we create information and facilitate information is a conversation that's ongoing for people who work in this field as science communicators. And one of the things that Tufte, I think, really opened up for many people was this idea that the visual display of quantitative information could provide a meaningful channel to help science information to be more relevant to more people. And he offers very constructive tools to do that. I want to talk a little bit about why. I mean, visuals become the sort of broadband for discovery because, well, 60% of our frontal cortex is dedicated to processing visual information. And so it becomes a much more accessible way to convey information faster, to convey more information, and to help people retain. We know that people who see information are more likely to retain information than they've heard. And that's one of the tools that I think we have as science communicators to really start getting information out to the public is to take not only a narrative style, but to include those charts and graphs and other tools that complement the sort of multidisciplinary approach to science communication is becoming increasingly relevant as people get interested in science because it is a part of their everyday lives and is increasingly, people are increasingly aware of how science is impacting their lives with all the tools that we have available to us, with the consumer level tools that allow us to manipulate data and set up our own data sets and manage this. With IBM declared 2012 the year of analytics. And I think that that forecasts what we are going to contend with increasingly are new analytics and things that are counted that try to portray the world around us. And so it will become increasingly important to help contextualize what that information is about for audiences in any number of areas, that it would be energy issues or climate change issues, biotech issues, really helping people recognize what information is available to them, how they can make sense of it. This visualization of information is appealing. It's attractive, and it is something that for an audience, a general audience that is competing for attention, news organizations are looking for more creative ways to put in, to put their news in front of those folks, and these visuals become increasingly important. The challenge, though, is working with the creators of that initial content, that science that we want to portray, and helping figure out how do you make a data set a mindset, taking that information and bringing it to the fore so that it's relevant and immediately attractive to the audiences that are out there. And this is not, this idea that the tools that we have to use as communicators, they change. This is not a new idea. And the role of tools in helping to express science has, they've been very important for hundreds of years, which is why I want to talk a little bit about the telescope. Telescope is 400 years old, and it was one of the first instruments that scientists used to help bring the external world closer to them. It was an opportunity to start to see the universe differently, and that led to new conclusions. If we think about the controversy around the heliocentric world and the use of the telescope in helping to create that controversy, we can start to look at an analogy that helps us think about the computer age a little bit differently and how that's going to start to affect our craft as science communicators. And so think, these tools are many. There's the telescope, there are microscopes, cameras. All of these things helped us extend the human senses and bring the external world closer, helped us interpret and understand the world around us. But these tools were not just for scientists. The telescope got incorporated into military applications, and soldiers used it. Artists used it to create pictures and to imagine worlds beyond our own. And so the notion that science tools become an important aspect to how we understand science and how we can narrate science is one that is worth considering. I think what's also important to remember is that these tools can be used in two different ways. Copernicus did not look through the telescope and understand the nature of the universe, or he had to look at the stars as data points and analyze those data points and offer an interpretation as a scientist first. And so what we start to recognize, even in today's world, with the increased computing power and the computational abilities of the machines that we have today, scientists still are required to pull in information and look at those data sets and interpret them once for themselves. And so that information that comes through and those tools, they influence our conclusions. Well, they influence first the scientists' conclusions, and they have the potential to influence our conclusions. But we have to really think through how that process works. We'll talk a little bit about how the tools work today. I mentioned the increased computing capacity. And this is a visualization from the Idaho National Laboratory, which I've worked with for a few years. They have an advanced test reactor. It's a small nuclear reactor that they can put materials into and look at the effects of high heat and radiation exposure over time. They do experiments on different materials. And the test reactor has been used in a variety of explorations in both the nuclear energy field, but also materials science. But what's significant is in recent years, the advanced computing capacity that they have at the laboratory allows them to take all of these different programs that allow scientists to recreate natural processes. If you remember high school physics class, you can distill basic physics principles into mathematical formulas, which means they have a distinct solution. And so there have been, for many years, there have been programs that break down these physical processes into computations. This is a computational mesh that they use at the advanced test reactor to mirror dozens of these natural processes. And so as the computing capacity increases, and the greatest gains have really taken place in the last 5 years within the National Lab System and some of the basic fundamental scientist work that's taking place, they've been able to really start to look at 3D, three-dimensional models that have multi-physics approaches that take dozens of databases, dozens of models and simulations, and layer them one over another. So that they, in computations that used to take days or weeks or months to do, they can really compress that time frame and look at things on a very granular level in a very short amount of time. And so it's expanded the human senses that much further. And it's started to, because of the visualization technology that they have access to create these types of images, where they can start to see the atomic scale to the system scale. And this is the interior of the reactor. So what you see are the actual, if you're familiar with how a nuclear reactor is constructed, the fuel rods go into those different channels. And each of the different colors represents a different physical process, whether it could be the heat, it could be radiation exposure, it could be material structure. All of these things get mapped in a single visualization. So the scientists can start to look. And remember that Tim Berners-Lee created hyperlinks while at CERN. And this is sort of the next iteration of this idea of being able to drill down into scientific information by looking at an entire system, in this case, the operating nuclear reactor, and drill down to the atomistic level in terms of what's going on within those individual atoms of the materials that are placed in that reactor for experimentation. So this is all very heady stuff and maybe moderately interested if you're interested in nuclear energy. But the reason I bring it up is because this high fidelity computing that they're doing within the scientific community is very, very exciting for the scientists that I work with. And they want to share this information with the general public so that people understand the level of information that they have access to now that they didn't have before. The worlds that they're able to unlock with the new tools that they have. And so this starts to inform how other people start to look at information and data sets. And we see the same thing happening with the social scientists. So as researchers get together and start to share the models and simulations that they're able to create, we start to see these models recreated in other fields. So whether it's energy efficiency or I mentioned climate change, all of these things start to matriculate into other models and simulations, and we have things evolve like CompStat in New York, or in Santa Monica, where they have predictive policing models that are taking the same principle of really building out these models of science on a level by database by database, integrating them all into one pile, and then starting to look at how things change in those communities. The problem, as I see it, is that nature maps mathematically very nicely. However, human behavior doesn't work so well. And so that's where these models and simulations and the computing capacity we have access to starts to become more complex, and the role of science communicators becomes more important, because not everything that counts can be counted. And in an age of analytics and big data, where we have the opportunity to do computer-aided reporting, and we have search engines that are optimized so that everybody feels that they can go into a search engine and find the answer to their question, this idea becomes increasingly important to figure out how do we put things back into context or keep them in context when the information becomes available. And I think this is really challenging, and I'm here this week in part to try to figure out what ways people are doing this, because this is not anything that there's a simple answer to. Science has been controversial for millennium and will probably continue to be. But I think we're entering a new age where if we don't find good ways to keep things in context, we're going to see a lot of faith lost in the scientific method overall. And we'll have more of these polarized debates where science goes out the window and it's all about identity. It's all about what do you believe or not believe. It's not really about any underlying facts that might be out there. So I want to look at some examples of things that can be counted or maybe not counted so well. And the first example I want to show is how many folks have explored the data.gov sites. Some familiarity with that. So when the first day that President Obama was in office, he issued commonly known as the Transparency Memo, which basically said it was now the federal government's objective to make information available first and consider any security concerns, any reasons. The default position would be make information available rather than figure out a reason why you should let information out. And that memo has been really, really influential in taking large federal data sets and making them accessible. And so if you go to data.gov, there are a whole slew of different federal agencies' databases in machine-readable format that you can go and download. And every agency is responsible for finding pieces of information that they're collecting. And I think the impetus behind this is that the fact is, if taxpayers are paying for data to be collected, they should probably see some benefit from the accessibility of that information. And this is a tool that allows developers and organizations alike opportunities to create mashups, to find new ways to put that information into context, new ways to use that information for both context, but also for discovery, and to tell stories and to find news stories. And so data.gov is really, I think, an exciting thing to see happen because at the Chicago Justice Project, we've been working on transparency issues for about 7 years, five years as an organization incorporated, and to see this finally start to take shape at the top levels of government is really very exciting. But just to kind of show, to provide a sort of object lesson of the challenges of making this kind of information available, I want to show you the Environmental Protection Agency. I watched this happen last year, and I thought it was a really, really telltale sign of the challenges ahead. The EPA maintains radiation monitoring units all over the country where they monitor background radiation on an ongoing basis. And they started making this information available through their website. their toxics release inventory is also available. They have lots of things available. And they have for a long time. It's been a commitment of the EPA to make information available to the public. Last year, after the incident, after the earthquake and tsunami in Japan knocked out the nuclear reactors there, the EPA website became suddenly much more popular than it had ever been before. And they saw huge amounts of traffic coming to their radiation monitoring site because everybody wanted to see, okay, well, am I going to be affected by this radiation release in Japan? And remember, the EPA originally set this up for concerned communities and scientists that were working on research. And so it wasn't the most user-friendly website at the time, last spring. And so when people would come in, they would see something like this when they would put in their zip code. And now, this is the near real-time gross gamma count rate data. I can't tell you what that is. But I can tell you that when most people were coming into the EPA website and looking at peaks and valleys in the town nearest them, they were not happy and were very concerned. And so the EPA got calls. The EPA saw the spike in the traffic to their website. So they put a disclaimer on the website when you would come in at the time that said, this was probably about April of last year. The disclaimer said, radiation data can be very difficult to understand. Please click here for our frequently asked questions. Well, the general public that was visiting the site really didn't like to be told they were too dumb to look at these charts. And so then the EPA saw another round of commentary to their effort to make information available to the public. And so the site has gone through iterations to try to figure out really, they weren't putting it up there to create false concern about what is manageable radiation, background radiation levels. It was there for scientific purposes. And so how do they manage that public interest in scientific data in a responsible way? And one of the things that started to emerge as the best solution to this were mashups by other people. And this idea that citizens have a role in helping to make sense out of all of the information around them. This is a mashup with Google Maps and the EPA radiation monitoring data, where some graduate students at Caltech put these things together and started to tell the story that they thought was of greatest interest to the public in terms of looking at the colors show the relative radiation level compared to different locations. So they start to tell a story a little bit different, a little bit differently. This also took the shape of another set of graphics that started to circulate last summer by artists and folks that were just really looking to understand the news themselves that created tools. My favorite was a radiation dose chart, a relative radiation graphic by a web comic at XKCD. And this guy, Randall Monroe, so he's in the aerospace industry, but he built a great graphic because he wanted to make sure that this information was clear. He sourced all kinds of public content that he got on online, created a graphic that articulated relative radiation dose so well that it circulated virally through Boing 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 and other sites, and it became the de facto tool that people used to understand relative radiation dose so they could look at those numbers that were being reported from Japan and have some context for them. So here we see this deep science that's taking place and how user demand to interact with that information starts to create some interesting solutions to how to understand science. But the challenge is still that idea of relative risk and keeping science research in context. Will Rogers used to say that people want to know that you care before they care what you know. And this is often my response to scientists when they say, well, the facts should just speak for themselves. And figuring out this spot in terms of how do you show people you care? What do you need to care about? Because I think one of the challenges for scientists and researchers is what they care about most is research and discovery and finding this new information. And so sometimes when we're so deep into things that we're excited about, it's hard to put ourselves in the position of someone else, our audience, and imagine what it is that's relevant to them. And this is how the nature of visual communication and some of the infographics and charts and displays of science become really important. You think about, I'm going to mention Tufte again and the work he did around PowerPoint and the Columbia Space Shuttle disaster. It's a really good example of how the tools we use to communicate influence our conclusions. Tufte talks about the cognitive style of PowerPoint and how the use of bullets falsely, in some cases, prioritizes information so that what comes across to the audience is not necessarily what we intend or what the science intends to come across. And so you think about where this goes. It becomes important to really recognize how does an audience understand something like a hypothesis. A hypothesis in the scientific community means something very different than what a hypothesis means to a layperson. You know, facts for a scientist are often very provisional because they're always looking for more. And when we talk about a scientific consensus, it doesn't mean that it's written in stone. A scientific consensus typically suggests that there is broad agreement and multiple opinions pointing to the same idea. But when we talk about a consensus with people who are not in the scientific field, the feedback we get from them is consensus is, well, we all agree. It's like we all agree we're going to go to lunch together. And it's just simply a matter of opinion. There's no underlying facts to that. So this idea of really helping to articulate and develop a greater sense among public audiences about the difference between error bands and risk assessment, these ideas, I think, become really important as we start to talk about making science more interactive. And that's what we're doing at the Chicago Justice Project. I mentioned that the natural sciences have the advantage of being explicable in mathematical terms, and we recognize that policing doesn't break down so neatly. And so 5 years ago, we formed the Chicago Justice Project, and this was a labor of our executive director, Tracy Siska, had been working for the Better Government Association in the early 90s and had amassed banker's boxes filled with public records about the Commander Burge trials and prosecutions. So it was a police commander who was convicted of torturing suspects in the 2nd Police District in Chicago in the 1960s. And so we had decades worth of records that Tracy had put together through the Better Government Association. And this information was there, and people kept calling and asking for it. Because in the state of Illinois, when you file a Freedom of Information request, they keep a record of who asked for what, who got what. So it was on record that we had this the information, and people kept calling and asking for it. And we finally, Tracy said, oh, there's got to be a better way for me to help people get access to the banker's boxes of paper that I have. So we started looking at ways to digitize and make those records machine readable. And it was a little more complicated than what we thought it would be. And it opened up this whole other world, recognizing that the multiple agencies in the city of Chicago were still all at this tipping point in terms of figuring out how they were going to maintain their own electronic data. And so in that, we saw an opportunity to start to help organize public organizations, community organizations, to help identify which data sets were going to be most relevant to public decision making, so that we could take that notion of community policing that was rolled out in the city in the early 90s and bring it back, because that computational statistics had really taken over. And policing decisions were being made within the police department with information that the public didn't have access to. And so in community meetings, we would negotiate about whether or not a police district should be closed, and the police department and the city would have all kinds of stats and numbers to back up their argument. And all we had were citizens' experiences. And so we wanted to find a way, really negotiate a way to start to find a new approach to deal with that. It's not a police accountability project that we're working on. This is really about facilitating trust between the community and the police department and the law enforcement agencies that are there to serve it. And that trust is what helps to make that science meaningful again and to keep it in context so that you've got good data. You see these types of tools emerging all over the country, where you have maps, where you can, in D.C., where I now live, they have Stumble Safely was their initial rollout of their online police blotter. And it was exactly that. It was a great way to see where the recent muggings were so that you could pick a different street to walk home. But those maps offer a certain level of interest and detail, but they really are just taking the police blotter and putting it online. What we're talking about is being able to create a citizens' open data access project that allows citizens to be able to see how law enforcement agencies are taking information from the people that they're interacting with in the communities and making sense out of it for policing decisions. And this speaks to this idea of how do you throttle all of this huge information flow that's out there. The streams of relevant data on any particular issue are still very disjointed. And this is why search engines succeed or fail, because they're good at helping people navigate those different streams of information and bring them together in a way that's meaningful to people to answer their specific questions. What we learned very quickly when we initiated this project was that law enforcement, from the time a call for service is made to the point that a case is either thrown out or prosecuted, there are 7 different databases involved, 7 different groups that are probably more than that in terms of databases, 7 different organizations. You've got your 911 service, you have the police department, you've got your courts, you've got the prosecutor's office, you've got the corrections facilities, you've got the sheriff's office, all these different places. So making sense out of this is not an easy task. And this isn't something that we expect to be able to roll out a prototype immediately. We've been very slow and deliberate because we recognize that this is information that really does affect people's lives in really profound ways. So there are privacy and security issues that we need to address. But we also recognize that as long as law enforcement organizations are collecting this information, there are ways to use it to the public good by incorporating public input in terms of what this information really means. So what we've started doing is taking data sets that we've been able to access. Initially, when we started, we were using the Freedom of Information Act, and we were working with local law firms that were pulling these types of data sets for their own cases that they were working on. And so we were able to start to collect data sets. And we have a wide range of things. We have them available for download. They're machine readable. They're extensible so that people can use them for what they need to get done. But in that process, what we really want to do is start to work with our community advisory board and the task forces that we have put together to figure out ways to make these things user-friendly for advocates and caseworkers and social service agencies within the city of Chicago. And we've made tremendous gains in doing that. One of the first things that we did was a sort of unexpected win. We had someone volunteer to help us build a scraper. So we started taking some information initially from local media sources, and then from the clear site that the Chicago Police Department put up. We started scraping the data, and we did it quietly for the first year so our scrapers wouldn't get disrupted by changes to the sites we were interested in collecting information from. But then by the time the police department really went full force with their clear site and started marketing it, we already had a year's worth of information behind us that we were able to integrate in this. We've been having volunteers from 30 different community organizations help us code this information. And in the process, they are learning about how the police department and the affiliated organizations, how they are tracking and coding information themselves. And so we're starting to develop a common language so that we can work with the mayor's office, the police departments, the sheriff's office, the courts, and be able to speak to each other using a common language that helps to identify what this information is really all about. As we go through this, the case status and coding have proven out to be two of the most important things that community members are interested in, because they've recognized that the case status, whether or not a case is open, closed, pending, it influences what other agencies they need to integrate into to get more information. And then the coding is also very interesting, because depending on how a case gets coded when it's initially processed by law enforcement agencies, that's how it gets reported up through state and federal organizations. So if we want to cross-reference information, this becomes very important. And we start to see gaps between what some of the information that social service agencies are picking up out of the Department of Health and Human Services versus what the law enforcement agencies. So we're starting to identify where these gaps are and starting to look for which questions can we really answer and what problems can we start to address by using this information in a meaningful way. So those are just to kind of give you an idea. We've learned a lot in the process of working with the Chicago Justice Project in terms of figuring out how to integrate big data into meaningful solutions for communities. And we work, we see this as an extension of a journalistic endeavor to really provide a fourth estate that provides some context to what's happening in the world around us. Obviously, we've worked really hard to first do no harm. And while there are lots of prototypes and lots of other cities that are looking at how to bring crime data online, we're working and monitoring, following those really closely to look at some of those best practices. And we want to make sure first that as we bring this stuff online, that we're serving the community interest needs. So we are working with our advisory board includes it includes lawyers, it includes the Cook County Board of Advisors, it includes we've got a state representative, alderman. We're really working to bring in high-level decision makers at the city, as well as people who are working on a day-to-day basis with victims of crime and people affected by crime to make sense out of all this. We recognize that one of the keys is figuring out what the problem is that we want to solve before we just put a lot of data out there. And that's how our community advisory board decided to form the Sexual Assault Task Force, because community organizations saw that as one of the first frontiers that really needed to be addressed, because there were disparate reports from community members in terms of calls to 911 for service versus what was being reported by the responding agencies. So that's really where we're starting to do our work. And we're looking to structure the stuff collaboratively that way. So we're working with the police department and the courts, because they recognize that they have to get a handle on the mounds of data that they're collecting as well. And if they can help make their systems more efficient by answering community needs, everybody's better off. So we hope eventually, we hope and anticipate that this process will help us generate a user interface and a site that houses all of these data sets in a single repository that is very accessible to community members. And we've started doing needs assessments right now. We'll start doing user testing next year and start to really facilitate a collaborative process that brings this information to community members. So that's, I mean, I think I talked a lot about how science is changing, and criminology is an important science. And so I wanted to provide that one example, that what we see in the community or the Chicago Justice Project, to really get to this idea of how science is changing and how that changes our responsibility as science communicators to put things in context. And I really would love your questions and comments about this topic in the moments that we have left.
What about climate change? Is this on? You can hear me. What about climate change? How do we get to the people who are still questioning?
The climate change issue is one that I work on in my day job. And I'm still trying to figure out what data sets are out there that people can start to use, because I think that will be part of how it might be able to help people see the science behind it. Because climate science is a term that we throw around a lot, but it doesn't really reflect the actual science that shows that the Earth is changing in dramatic ways. And so I'm working with a coalition of scientists right now, of science professional science organizations, so the geologists and the meteorologists and the oceanographers. And when you start to break down climate science into its component parts, I think you have the opportunity to amplify those voices rather than box off all of your climate scientists as climate scientists. It's been a very effective rhetorical tool to isolate what is a large body of work that points a certain direction.
Hi, my name is Anjali. I'm a journalist. I can see kind of tangentially how a working journalist on Deadline might use some of this stuff, but I'm wondering if you could elaborate more on how you see this as relevant to the mass media or even to, you know, Joe Smo blogger.
One of the things that we learned that we were really surprised by was when we initially set up the scraping tool that we put together, we were really just looking to train an algorithm to help us do searches of the data that we had. But when we did that, we were using all of the local news organizations' coverage that we could find to help set that up. So what we learned, because we had our community advisory board participating in that process, they were really interested in running searches against what mainstream media was talking about in the city of Chicago and what issues popped up. And so they were running what we found. So our partners kept running reports to say, well, gosh, the Chicago press has only run 6 stories about LGBT violence and hate crimes in the city in the last year. And so they were actually using it to go to local editors and start to say, hey, how can we help you get information about what's going on in the community here? So it's been used in that format. I think ultimately the data sets that we have available, we've worked a lot with a couple local reporters in the city to help us do some of the deep dives and get access. So we've augmented the resources that a couple of local journalists have available in order to do investigative reporting, because their organizations don't necessarily support that level of time and input. But if we think we have a reporter who is going to be able to narrate the story, if we can find the information, we can work through our network and the law firms that we're working with, the community groups, the courts, the city contacts, and we've been able to pull together content that then helps to provide some foundation for reporting later. A really good example you can go back and look at is our police board report that we did. We worked and used we used the Freedom of Information Act to get a bunch of information about police accountability mechanisms in the city, and we did a quantitative study in terms of how many people were how people were showing up to vote, what kind of demographics of the cases, that sort of thing. And we used that information then served as the foundation for some other larger reports that were published in local media. I hope that answers your question.
Hi. This might be peripheral to what you discussed, but I was curious if you could talk a little bit about the authentication and archiving of born digital data and information. You know, in the old days, we would have the government printing office, and you would know there's a book, and you're going to be able to go back and find the source and that it's stable. But for information that's put up online, that might be the only place it's published, and when it's harvested or scraped into other presentations, there's the question of how do you know it's the real stuff? And this is a librarian's question that I heard from a couple places too. So,
yeah, I'm afraid we have worked really hard to make sure that we have mechanisms in place to cross-check the information that we're integrating in, and we have been working with the IT managers at the various agencies to really help identify what fields of information they collect and what they would be willing to share publicly and how it gets cleaned up. So we're at that stage right now. I don't think I can answer your question about how they archive it on their side, because I think some of the agencies are still getting a handle around that themselves.
I work at an agency where our main audience is healthcare professionals themselves, so scientists. What about visualizing data for that audience? I mean, are the facts good enough on their own for them, or what would you advise about the best challenge of visualizing the facts and telling the narrative for scientists themselves?
For scientists themselves? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is where Tufte's original work is really very relevant. I think continue to be amazed at how scientists use the tools available to them to create visualizations on their own. And when I, as a communications person, ask my scientists to give me sources for brochures or websites, give me pictures, I need images, and they send me things that don't say anything to me, but they look cool, I guess. I don't know what it is. But I always have that conversation. I'm like, this is a great picture. It doesn't really do what I need it to right now. I think scientists have a different set of needs. And so if I understand your question, I mean, I think getting information back to the criminologists or back to climate scientists about what's relevant, there's always that challenge. The hardest thing is making sure that it retains the integrity of their original work. And I think that is the way to make that it needs to be approached, to say, we're going to make a graphic that speaks to scientists, but it also has some appeal to people who don't know anything about this yet. It really does have to fall down to that sort of common denominator of the scientific conclusion. And that's where this distinction that between narrative and discovery, I think, is really so important, because a visualization that a scientist uses to discover something new is very different than a visualization that somebody uses to tell a story. And oftentimes the infographics that I see have not necessarily made that distinction. And so then it's just a big jumble, because you look at it and you're not sure if it's supposed to tell you something or if you're supposed to figure something out. And typically, you know, if it's the wrong audience, they're going to figure out the wrong thing.
Hi, my name is Amanda. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts also about, and again, this may be a bit specific, but in a almost exhibit setting, so if there's something that's more experiential, if you have any thoughts about sort of how to structure science for basically the general population.
I think what we've really been learning is that the most important part is to sort of start at the audience level and figure out what it is that they want to know. There is a body of academic work right now about the knowledge deficit disorder and this idea that scientists tend to approach their audience to say, if they just knew what I know, they would agree with me. And that's typically not the case. It's not that people don't know something. It's that they don't care. And so how do you figure out how to get them to care about what you know? It's the Will Rogers quote. You've got to show them that you care. And I think implicitly that means spending some time on the front end of a educational project, figuring out what questions is the audience going to ask me about this information? How do I back into this so that I can... The radiation monitoring example is one that I use because what I saw happen was scientists putting science information out there because they cared about that, but not really thinking about the fact that what people really care about is whether or not they're being irradiated, and that's a bad thing. And so what we saw evolve in a space that has a long history of communication challenges was, you know, people, artists and bloggers were creating their own tools to decipher the science. And so they sort of met in the middle because they figured out what question they wanted to answer first. And it was a very simple question. It had nothing to do with Japan. It had to do with relative radiation levels. And what does that mean to me? So I think that's how I would approach it. Was that stop or five? I think maybe... Okay, so I think we have time for one more question, if anybody has one.
No, you go ahead.
Mine might be pretty simple. What are some of the tools and platforms that you've been using to come up with this, like geolocation stuff and all this?
Oh, sure. Well, we actually, if you're familiar with Everyblock, we started with some of the code that they had put together, and then we OpenBlock had some additional things, and then our folks kind of built from there. And so that's what the scraper's been built in. Otherwise, the different agencies that we're working with, their data is all over the place. So we get all kinds of stuff. And I can get you the full list if you're interested afterward, because I don't remember it off the top of my head. So anyway, thank you so much. I hope this was interesting. I'm really appreciative that you guys explored this with me today. Thanks.